Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Officially, according to federal numbers, the Great Recession ended in June of 2009. But for a long time, many Americans didn't feel like it. Jobs were created, but wages and benefits remained low, and people continued to hold their wallets closely. Now, though, it's almost a full 7 years out from recession's end. And here in New Hampshire, the economy's looking pretty good. Our unemployment rate is the nation's second lowest. Several key sectors, including construction and home sales, are picking up. And finally, paychecks are getting a little bit fatter. Still, what economists call residual nervousness remains, with many Granite Staters looking cautiously at the economic landscape ahead. Today in The Exchange, a roundup of New Hampshire's economic news, and let's hear from you. Do you feel this residual nervousness, or do you feel confident and see that economic confidence reflected around you? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org, find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Jeff Feingold is here, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good seeing you, Laura.
Also with us, Steve Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. Steve, thanks for taking time out.
Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Russ Tebow, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm in Laconia. And Russ, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Well, Russ, that theme of caution remains. How come?
Well, I think it's really a tale of two economies that we're dealing with here. On the one hand, our numbers look terrific. As you pointed out, our unemployment rate, 2.6%. The state has added almost 40,000 jobs since the recovery began here in 2010. Wage growth has kicked back in, up about 12% since 2010, which is higher than the rate of inflation for the first time in a long time. So the economy is doing very well, actually, phenomenally well. That unemployment rate is the lowest since 2000, the year 2000, which is terrific. But recently, the Business and Industry Association surveyed New Hampshire residents, and only a third said that they were better off than they were a year ago. And the kind of numbers that you get, that you look at, would suggest that, you know, everybody should be feeling pretty good. But in fact, they aren't. Only a third said they feel better off, and about 64% said about the same. So people aren't feeling as good as the numbers suggest they should be.
Why not?
I think that you go to yet another survey, which the Federal Reserve Board did last year, and 47%, and I know I'm talking a lot of numbers and it's hard to grasp these over the radio. I always have a hard time doing that, but focus on this. 47% of Americans surveyed said that if they had an unexpected $400 bill, they wouldn't be able to pay it. Nearly half. So what I think is going on is basically that the duration of this downturn has been the longest since the Great Depression, and it has tapped household resources. That's number one. And I think also the recovery has not been uniform. It's been spotty. The recovery is strong but spotty. Some sectors of the economy are doing very well. Some places in New Hampshire are doing very well, but not everybody and not everywhere.
So the recession tapped people's financial resources to the point where if they had a sudden $400 emergency purchase, you know, some appliance breaks down or something, they say they couldn't cover it.
They couldn't cover it. They'd have to borrow money or they'd have to sell something in order to cover a $400 expense. Yeah. So,
Jeff, what do you think?
I also think that, you know, despite, you know, the very positive unemployment numbers, I think really what's happened is that, you know, our economy underwent a really major restructuring because of the recession, the financial meltdown. And we lost a lot of better paying jobs. You know, a lot, manufacturing jobs still not where they used to be, obviously many years ago. And the other thing is that people were forced to take jobs that paid less, and in many cases are taking more than one job to not even able to earn what they once did earn to keep up with their bills, you know, to keep their house going, you know, to keep their mortgage payments going. They don't have the same money, which attests to the idea of, like, maybe I don't have $400 this month to pay this bill because I have to pay my mortgage or my property taxes, which continue to rise, as we know in New Hampshire.
Steve Norton, your thoughts on this broad trend that Russ is laying out, sort of this residual nervousness?
I'd take a look at Massachusetts, which has an unemployment rate which is 20% higher than New Hampshire's, and they're growing four times the rate we are. So measures hanging all of your hats on one hook, the unemployment rate is probably not the thing to think about. GDP growth in New Hampshire is 47th in the country. In terms of productivity, we're 33rd in terms of post-recession growth in gross state products. So we're growing much more slowly than the rest of the country. Our unemployment rate has as much to do with migration patterns as it does with job growth. We're just not seeing the people come in. So I think there are a lot of structural problems with New Hampshire's economy, which people are feeling.
Give us a little more there, Steve. Structural problems. What do you mean?
Well, for the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we saw incredible growth in really highly educated individuals. The Massachusetts Revolution, if you will, forced economic activity over the border into New Hampshire. And we saw this amazing growth that stalled. Both the migration and the expansion of Massachusetts hasn't been as strong as it was in the 70s and 80s. And so we haven't seen that bleed up into the across the border.
Well, all of you mentioned the unemployment rate and, you know, take it with a grain of salt, although it's hard not to look at that, Russ, and say, wow, 2.6%, I think is what you said, second lowest in the nation. So I wonder how you sort of partner that with the other number that Steve gave that I think is relevant, that we're growing slowly.
Yeah, we are growing
slowly.
In terms of
GDP.
The Census Bureau just released some population estimates for various states, and New Hampshire's population grew at less than 2% total between 2010 and 2015. So we're slow growing. But at the same time, there is more to this than just the unemployment rate. If you look at job growth by sectors of the economy, whether they pay above average wages, about average wages, below average wages, actually we've had a pretty good turn recently, particularly in professional and technical services. So we've added about a third of the jobs we've added, which isn't huge, but it's better than it has been, are in sectors that pay above average wages, particularly professional and technical services. During the last decade, we lost a ton of over 30,000 manufacturing jobs. Manufacturing's growing a little bit. So there is a bloom on the rose. But again, you get back to people saying, I don't feel much better than I did, you know, a year or two ago. So it is, as I said, a tale of two economies. The number economy, which looks great, and the people economy, which doesn't feel so good to a lot of folks.
So professional and technical services, engineers, attorneys. Jeff Feingold, I heard that BAE Systems
yes.
hiring several hundred people. That's another company that's considered, you know, a good place to work for, good wages and so
actually,
forth.
Yeah, BAE Systems announced they're building a big expansion in Merrimack, another expansion. They expanded their Nashua plant, and they're talking about 300 jobs. And those are, you know, the cream of the crop jobs in New Hampshire. And actually, there's talk in Hooksett, GE, where they build airplane engine components, they're expanding, and they'll be also be adding several jobs. You know, I'm not quite sure of the number, but dozens of jobs there too. And those are also those kind of jobs that we're talking about that we desperately, you know, we had lost so many of, and they're coming back, which is a good sign. And it's interesting they're both in the same sector, which is something we could talk about later. But it has something to do with defense spending and that kind of stuff.
About, and then you add to that almost 2 million square feet of new warehousing space along Pettingill Road in
yes.
Londonderry, a lot of good-paying jobs. The warehousing, wholesaling, trade sector of the economy pays well above average wages.
Yes.
A lot of
So for going forward, there is like this feeling that, you know, maybe things are getting better, but it's a feeling. You know, we don't know this.
Well, economists feel that way. But if you go back to that BIA survey again, 27% of the people that were surveyed said they'll be better off a year from now. They think they'll be better off a year from now than they are this year. So the optimism isn't there.
Yeah.
The sense that things are going well isn't there.
There's an underlying anxiety. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, there really is. You just talk to people on the street and they
People are still nervous.
That's a perfect segue to go to our listeners, guys. And I would love to hear from folks this hour. How are you feeling economically? Do you feel this underlying anxiety, or do you hear about some of the pickup in wages and employment and feel pretty good about your own economic prospects? Let's hear from you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And up first is Sean in Salem. Hi, Sean. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, so I was just calling in, you know, talking about the housing market. You know, I'm 28 years old, and I can probably count on one hand the amount of people that I went to high school with that are homeowners. And I'm just kind of wondering, you know, where that market is heading as far as people my age being able to actually afford a house, which doesn't seem like a feasible option for me or really anyone I know at this point.
So what's your own housing situation, Sean?
I'm currently living with in-laws because I honestly can't even find an affordable rent in southern New Hampshire.
Really? But you've got a decent job?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you're the housing guy, Russ Tebow. Here he is. He's a millennial, by the way. That's the demographic that New Hampshire is desperate to keep.
And,
he's got a good job but can't find affordable housing.
Steve Center and myself worked together on the state's housing needs analysis of 5 years, and the millennials are really postponing home buying to some degree because their household situation isn't settled. They're not married yet. They're not sure they're in their right job. They're not sure they're living in the right place. But as Sean pointed out, also a lot of them simply can't afford, despite exceptionally low interest rates. I mean, if you do the numbers, housing's very affordable, but not for everybody. And particularly young households have a really struggling time to pull it off.
Steve, do you want to jump in on that?
The real question about migration for New Hampshire, most people say that we will go as our housing markets go going forward. Can people afford to live in New Hampshire? And so far, the answer is no.
If you look at the average price in New Hampshire, median price, it's about $225,000 for a single-family home. Versus a national average of $185,000. So somebody moving from Ohio, thinking of moving to New Hampshire, this housing thing is really gonna be a shock.
Well, and apparently, from what I've read and heard, the state's housing market is picking up. Here's a headline from the Union Leader. The state's housing market is enjoying its highest sales in more than a decade. So it doesn't sound like prices are going to come down for our caller anytime soon.
Median prices have been rising consistently for the last few years. And you know, I just wanted to say one thing about the level of housing costs. When you look at the great booms that New Hampshire went through in the 80s and 90s, that was because a lot of it was because our housing prices were lower than certainly Massachusetts, and that helped motivate people from Massachusetts to move to New Hampshire because you can get more house or the same house for much less money, and it's not the same anymore. I mean, Massachusetts is still very high real estate value is higher than New Hampshire, but New Hampshire isn't lower to that extent anymore. So that's one of the reasons for this idea of the migration that's not happening the way we would like to have it happen. And the other thing I just want to mention about millennials, you have to take into consideration is New Hampshire, unfortunately, we have the highest per capita student loan debt in the country, and when you have that kind of debt, you're going to put down a down payment on a house in addition when you're paying a student loan off. And it's really it's not helping the housing market at all.
And there are new federal regulations where there's a certain limit of, I think it's 45%. You can't be above that in terms of debt service and qualify for a safe harbor mortgage.
Yes.
You can still borrow. Banks can still lend. But if things go sour, the banks can be on the hook.
Exactly. So where's their motivation for that?
Right. Well, I thought it was interesting that Sean also mentioned, Russ, that he – couldn't even find a reasonable rental. I mean, I rented for years and years and years after college because, you're not sure where you're going to settle, and that's fine, but at least you have your own rental place.
Yeah. The housing prices went down a lot from an average of around 250 down to 185, 190 in New Hampshire during the downturn. Rents didn't drop at all.
No. Rent, yeah.
And vacancy rates among rental units now are around 2%, which the industry standard is 5%. So there aren't many units out there. And they are more expensive.
Yeah, there's not much of apartment rental stock. Actually, the legislature just passed a bill this session that's going to allow people to kind of have mother-in-law apartments in communities to kind of to help alleviate some of that demand for rentals.
Oh, that's a good point. Steve, you and I have talked about this before on the show, the idea that zoning laws and rules have prevented some of this rental and housing expansion.
Well, think about our entire zoning infrastructure was created in the 70s and 80s and 90s designed to slow growth. So we didn't want more people. We wanted 2-acre zoning. We wanted to make sure that we didn't weren't overgrown with growth in people and service needs. And now everyone's having to rethink that. This change in law around accessory use is just one. Others may be how do cities and largely cities these days encourage concentrated development of new types of housing? Because very frankly, a millennial is not going to want a 3-bedroom house in Salem. Yeah, or at least that's what all the surveys suggest. So,
like cities like Manchester, they're trying. There's been an effort for a long time to try to allow apartments above the stores, you know, in the retail operations in downtown Manchester, because that's a desirable place. People want to be moving to downtown Manchester. There's more amenities. There's more life in there. And that's true of other cities as well.
I'm so struck by what you just said, Steve Norton, that our current zoning policies are still designed to keep people out and slow growth down.
Yeah, that's right. And across the board. And if you go to any zoning meeting, you'll see that there's natural friction against development and growth because plans were developed in the 70s and 80s around communities to keep them in certain ways, keep certain types of growth out of the community. And Russ, you can probably speak better to this than I can about the rest of the community. But in Concord, for example, we have certain parts of the community where we don't allow clustered housing. People are changing their minds now. Maybe this is something we need to do to encourage workforce development or a different type of community than we wanted in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
So at least people like our caller Sean can get a rental, if not purchase his own house. Let's go back to our callers, gentlemen. And Steve's joining us from Nottingham. Go ahead, Steve. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. I'm a psychiatrist, so I like the idea of the emotions behind the thing. As I travel around, I see a lot of signs that say, we're hiring, jobs. So that should make you feel good. I want to talk about the existential view of the world. The world is, in fact, in major flux. We hear people talking about the unrest in the China Sea. We hear about what happened in Paris. We hear about ISIS. We see the election bashing America and saying we're not great now. And no matter what happened, there will be a change of administration. People get upset with change and the existential in the world we're in, it's a frightening world we live in.
You know, Steve, this is a great point, and I'm so glad you called, Russ, but I'm hearing from everybody on this. Russ, you first. This is what we started with at the beginning of our conversation today. There are a lot of good numbers out there. Not all good, as Steve Norton reminded us, but there are a lot of good indications. You've looked at wages. They're finally coming up as well. And yet our caller makes a good point. There's a lot of uncertainty in the broader world out there, and maybe that's reflected in people's economic anxiety.
I think people like Steve should take some courses in economics as well to help us that don't take courses in psychology because
there is
a whole field of economics that if I had it to do over, I'd probably really want to try to get a PhD in, which is called behavioral economics. Why do people behave the way they do? You know, and I think right now, Steve, you make a lot of good points. There's a lot of change going on. We're getting a lot of negative feedback from the presidential campaign that I think kind of puts a damper on people's attitudes. So I think that it's really is perception. Sometimes I've found over the years that perception lags reality, that it's off, that people are just not fully aware of what's really going on. This time around, I think the people really are aware of what's going on. And guess what? This recovery hasn't been uniform, hasn't been great for everybody. If you're a computer programmer, a systems analyst, it's good times right now. But if you're average blue-collar worker, it's difficult. It's challenging.
Yes.
You may have two jobs. You may be working only 29 hours a week. So the benefits are not uniform. But Steve makes a lot of great points.
If you think about it, you know, talk about it. Compare the price of gasoline to about a year ago or 2 years ago. It's gone up lately, but it's still basically $2 a gallon, which if you think about it just a few years ago, you never thought you'd see $2 again.
Right.
And you think every time someone goes to the pump, they'd say, oh, this is great. I'm only paying $2 a gallon. But it's not. It doesn't have that kind of effect.
So people are feeling economically grumpy.
But people would say that the real driver behind the economic expansion in the United States was fracking. And once we lost that, we lost all the tailwinds in our economic growth.
Okay.
And so losing gas prices going from $4 to $2 was actually bad for the New Hampshire economy.
We'll talk more in a minute. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at a month of economic headlines here in the Granite State, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're looking at some of the big economic numbers here in New Hampshire, including our very low unemployment rate, but also, as we're hearing, our low growth rates. Give us a call. How do you feel? Do you feel this residual nervousness that economists talk about when it comes to our financial future? Or do you feel confident and see that confidence reflected in your own life, in your own community? 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests for the hour are Russ Thiebaud, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm in Laconia, Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, and Steve Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. And Steve Norton, I did want to give you a chance to finish up just before the break. We were all responding to a very good question from our caller, Stephen Nottingham, who said he thinks there's some psychological stuff at work where things are good, but people don't feel like it.
Well, there's the volatility that we talked about. Uncertainty exists in the economy in ways that it hasn't probably in our economic lifetime. So there's that one part. But what I find fascinating is that if you had told me 2 years ago that we were going to put $800 billion into the United States consumers' hands by reducing oil prices and gas prices from $4 down to $2, and we'd still be seeing 1.5% or 2% growth in the economy, I would have called you crazy, because two-thirds of our economy is driven by consumer spending. So
that's a lot of extra cash for people.
It's a lot of extra cash that you would think people would spend. They'd feel confident or they'd save it. In large measure, people say that they're saving those dollars, not spending them. And the other part of the story is that that $800 billion was a big chunk out of the United States economy, because most of the growth, the really exuberant parts of the economy, had to do with fracking economies. And, you know, you read about maybe 3 years ago we started to see job growth in North Dakota and in Pennsylvania, where, you know, significant fracking was occurring. You started to see that exuberance and some increases in consumer spending, and then oil prices plummeted. Those economies fundamentally changed. They started laying off, and a lot of that tailwind that was created by this new resource industry in the United States of America really declined.
Russ?
Yeah, I think too, Steve, you make a very good point. Consumer spending this quarter, I mean, on Thursday we're going to get the GDP growth number for the U.S. economy in the first quarter, and it's probably going to disappoint a lot of people, partly because consumer spending has been flat during the first quarter, and the huge windfall that Steve spoke about, I think it came on the heels, again, of 7 years of draining your financial resources as a household, of borrowing more money for school, buying a new car, but financing it over 6 or 7 years instead of 3 years. So when energy prices went down, which probably put, I saw at one point, $3,000 into the pocketbook of an average household in northern New England. I think it's actually more than that, because prices have dropped since that was examined. You would think that that would stimulate a lot of growth in the economy, as Steve pointed out. In fact, it hasn't. And I think the reason why is people had to borrow money. Whatever liquid resources they had, a lot of households have dissipated it, so that when you get this windfall, you don't have to put so much money into the gas pump. You got somewhere else to put it.
You got to pay off those debts. But that's a good thing, right?
It is, in terms of households,
people, you know,
finances. In terms of economic growth, not so good.
The paradox of thrift, right?
That's yeah, there you go. That's
yeah.
right. Yeah.
Go ahead. Just explain it, just in case.
Well, if all of us start saving a ton of money, we're not spending money. If we're not spending money, then economic growth is thwarted. So.
And that's one of the arguments they're talking about with these huge corporations that are just kind of hoarding all their earnings that they've made, you know, over the last several years. Apple's one of them, where they have – I don't know how much money they have on hand. Hundreds of billions of dollars, and they're not reinvesting it. They're keeping it offshore. It's not being taxed and all that stuff. That's a – and that's another big criticism of why things have less – not – there's no oomph. You know, there's just not – there doesn't seem to be the real energy behind this any kind of economic growth.
Still, it's hard to argue, Jeff, that it's good for folks to pay off their debts. It's good for them to not go crazy. And, you know, we used to hear in the mid-2000s that, you know, people bought too much house that they couldn't afford, or they racked up credit card debt buying, you know, TVs that they didn't need. So there's a good side to this.
No, there's absolutely. Yeah. As I know personally, it's been a good thing. You know, you want to pay down your debt. The problem is, as Russ is saying, that's a good thing personally, but collectively for the economy, it's not necessarily a good thing.
The difference there is probably short-term versus long-term. It probably makes really good sense for the United States to rebalance its savings relative to what it was. We got probably a little too aggressive in our spending, and we might have a period of 10 years of slow growth, but it may position us to more effectively have an economic rebound in the future. And it might not be good in the short term, but it could be in the long term.
Let's take some more calls, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's go next to Jefferson. Sue is on the line. Hi, Sue. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. I just was listening and about the growth of new jobs down south, but wondering where we are in the North Country, because there are jobs available, but they're all between $7.50 and $10 an hour, not the high-paying jobs for those folks up here.
And Sue, how is your own economic situation in the North Country?
Okay, but my husband commutes to Concord every day.
Wow.
And I work from home with a contract out of Concord as well, and commute to Concord a few times a month.
Yeah, good thing gas prices are low, right, Sue?
For right now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for calling in. Interesting story, Russ.
Yeah. This gets at this whole idea of a spotty recovery, spotty prosperity. If you look at New Hampshire, if you look at Coos County, unemployment rate around 5.5%. If you look more to the southern part of the state where most of the people are, you're looking at unemployment rates closer to that state average, maybe a little bit below 2.5%. If you look at the Upper Valley, 2.5%. So, and then if you look at the quality of jobs, where the high-paying jobs are, they're in southern New Hampshire and not the North Country. So in terms of both the number of jobs and the unemployment rate and the quality of jobs, the North Country suffers. And I remember Steve, quite some time ago, his group talked about the two New Hampshires. And
call it two or three. But yeah, what we have recently found very interestingly that this recovery is largely in the cities. Mm-hmm. So if you look at job growth creation from 2000 to 2015, you know, Nashua accounted for 19% of the job growth, Manchester 22%, Portsmouth 23%, Dover 11%, and the rest of the state, which includes everyone else, was 25%, even though that accounts for half of the jobs.
So, okay, so
this has really been about, you know, some very isolated growth.
Go ahead, Jeff, and then I have another question for you, Steve. Yeah.
I was going to say, up in the North Country especially, you know, the economic just the picture up there has changed so dramatically in the last 20 years. You know, the closing of the mills, and those are really, really good jobs, and they just don't exist anymore. You had a couple of prisons in Berlin. Those are probably very good paying jobs, comparably speaking, but there's not as many of them. They just don't have the same impact. Unfortunately for the North Country, they become much more of a seasonal tourism economy, and they're trying really hard to get stuff. There's efforts to bring manufacturers in. There are manufacturers up there. It's not like completely dire. But when you think about the big savior right now is the balsams.
Well, let me ask you about that,
and that's
that,
a reflection of how this economy has changed so much.
Yeah, and Sue, thank you very much for the call. Here's a headline from the Union Leader that says that Les Otten, he's the new owner of the balsams, is going to present his site plan application to the Coos County Planning Board on April 26th. So
yeah.
That's today, I think, for the largest and most advanced ski resort on the East Coast.
Yes, that it's going to.
What do you make of that?
The plan is supposedly it's you know, God bless them. I hope it works out, but it's a massive, massive project that really I'm tend to be somewhat questioned. I just question some of this stuff. I think the potential for it to be an economic force in the North Country is really great. You know, we're talking about hundreds of jobs, construction jobs, and then jobs afterwards. But the idea of not having the highway infrastructure up there, it's not the same as it used to be when the balsams was built. You know, people used to come up there with steamer trunks and stay for 2 months. It's not the same world that we live in. But this is my point, is that just the idea of having a project like this is energizing people up in the North Country because they see some kind of ray of hope that this can help. And the real problem is that there's not – they don't have the kind of infrastructure that they really need, like in terms of the highways, in terms of broadband, that they really need to really move that economy and get it going.
Well, and we didn't get a lot of snow this winter.
No, and that
either,
has not helped at all.
Yeah.
I mean, the North Country actually was in better shape than, you know, the ski areas further to the south, but it still wasn't the same as it usually is.
Did you want to jump in, Russ?
Well, I think that hopefully part of the demographics of the country favor something like the Balsams, where there are more retirees, and not all of the retirees, but a number of retirees are in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
And so if you travel, go to a tourist area, you're going to find a lot of boomers or, people just a little bit older than the boomers there. The first study I did when I moved back to New Hampshire in 1976 was an economic development strategy for Berlin. That was, 40-some-odd years ago?
I'd love to look at that
at some
point. Yeah, see how much has changed and how much has changed.
And I think I could write another one, go up there and write another one product, and it would be productive to do it again today, 40 years later, still struggling.
Yeah.
So one thing I'll say about the ski area is, unfortunately, I don't know if you all saw that Jay Peak was put into receivership because it was a Ponzi scheme in essence. And so I think there are real questions about how you can support that kind of incredibly capital intensive in a place that doesn't have easy access to major highways or other things. And then I'll go back to this infrastructure thing. The Groveton Mill question, there was a fish farm that's interested in moving into New Hampshire.
Yes, I saw that, yeah.
And I sort of explored it a little bit, and the primary concern that they have is whether the infrastructure is there to support it or whether Groveton would have to invest in infrastructure to bring cleaner water or have more effective water distribution solutions than they currently have. So I think ultimately the possibility of economic development in the North Country is about this question of infrastructure.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a chicken and egg thing, right? What has to come first?
People want to go up there because it's cheap, but the infrastructure, housing, transportation, water, broadband don't exist in a way that would support a modern business.
Yeah, one of the things that have been talked about for decades up there is to have a east-west highway that would go from Portland through the North Country of Maine – New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, up to Montreal, and they said that one project could just change a lot, so much of the North Country. As I know, I live in New London, and when they built I-89, it changed the whole face of that whole area.
It changed it in ways good and bad.
And good and bad.
I mean, the North Country is beautiful and quiet and rural, and you can see moose and everything.
Absolutely. There's pros and cons to this, but the idea of having one highway would have a major economic effect on the North Country.
Okay, so Sue, very glad you called. And just getting back quickly, Steve, to what you said about a lot of the growth we've seen in New Hampshire is in the city. So Sue's husband commutes to Concord. She telecommutes to Concord. Portsmouth is doing well. Manchester, Nashua, and so forth. So let's say you're a policymaker, in the legislature or in the governor's office. What sorts of policies do you adopt at the state level, given this spotty city-based growth that you and Russ have talked about? What do you do?
Well, I guess the first question is, can you fight it? Or are we just acknowledging that across the country, rural areas have been in decline, and that's likely to continue, and that our job maybe in those rural areas is to help them balance out and right-size? There are lots of great things happening in the North Country. Littleton is a place of real economic vibrancy, but it's not spread out so much as it used to be. So maybe we focus our policies on trying to help those communities build out infrastructure in a different way. In the cities, there are innovation districts that are being created across the country. Schools are critically important, and I think in a world in which we're seeing declining enrollment and communities are seeing declining payments from the state for schools, I think that's a policy lever that you have to think about. Good schools will be required in our cities to bring migration. And Russ wants to jump in.
Oh. I don't mean to interrupt at all because I've enjoyed listening to you. I just was going to say there's sort of a catch-22. If you don't have the skilled labor force, you can't get the skilled jobs. And if you don't have the skilled jobs, you won't attract the skilled labor force. So it's a really tough nut to crack. We tried to do it with the Mount Washington Valley Technology Center. And what I found when I did the research for that was, on the one hand, you think this is a great place to live. It's terrific. You could live in Mount Washington Valley, ski in the morning, work in the afternoon, hike in the evening. Terrific lifestyle. And for technology where you really you're not moving goods, that infrastructure is a little less significant. But the labor, the availability of skilled labor is a driving force in the technology part of the economy, and it's just not there in the North Country.
Well, it's a policy question we should look at maybe in more detail next time we get together or another show, because it's interesting. Cities are really doing well here in New Hampshire, but there is this sort of spotty growth that all of you talk about. Let's go back to our listeners, gentlemen, and go to Keene, where Dan is waiting. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I apologize if you've already touched on this. But it seems, especially in this side of the state, taxation has a huge impact on housing costs. Even if you have no mortgage, you're looking at somewhere between $800 and $1,000 a month just to pay your taxes. And without the higher income paying jobs here in this area, I think that helps prevent our growth as we're becoming more of a college town versus a manufacturing town, which we once used to be.
Wow. Dan, thank you for calling in. Steve, I'm going to go to you first. This is a big debate in New Hampshire, the impact of taxation, but especially our high property taxes on regional economic growth.
Yeah. So there, you have to begin with the fact that we have very low tax levels, per capita tax levels.
Overall.
So, you know, depending on what year and what you're looking at, we're between third and fifth lowest per capita tax in the country. The share of our personal income is taxed less than the national average, et cetera. However, there are groups of people where the property taxes have a serious and significant negative impact on their ability to purchase housing. And those are those with high debt or those with on fixed incomes that can't pay as the taxes increase, particularly the elderly. So I guess from an economic development perspective, I'm less concerned about property taxes and more concerned about the stock of housing than that people want to buy.
Jeff?
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea that New Hampshire has, you know, we have a low per capita tax burden. But, you know, if it as we talked about with the economy in general, it's a matter of geography where you live. If you live in a place like in Sullivan County or parts of Belknap County up north, the property tax burden is extremely high. It's limiting your ability to have a better school system, to fix the roads better, to have water and sewer and all those other things they need. So it's really, when we talk about having a policy at the state level, there's so much that goes on at the local level that is affecting the economic growth of this economic development of the state that's happening locally when it comes to property taxes and other things. Because you could say that it's per capita, but you can go to many people who say that their taxes are way too high and they can't afford their taxes, and that other people who are paying barely anything because they're wealthy and they can afford their property taxes very easily.
Well, thanks for that call again from Keene. Good to hear from the southwestern corner of the state. Heading into the break, gentlemen, I want to share an email from John who says, just a quick comment on today's show. I live in the same house I grew up in, bought it from my parents. I'm 33, married with 4 kids. Growing up, my dad worked in local manufacturing, and that single income was enough for the same house, same standard of living, 5 family members. That same job is still available today at the local manufacturer, paying the same amount. But John says both my wife and I need to work and together make twice as much to live in the exact same house with the same standard of living. He says, in my mind, wages need to go up. You can't pay today's bills with a wage of 30 years ago. John, thank you for the comment. And in a moment, we'll take a lot more of your questions and comments. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's an economic news roundup. We're looking at some of the latest economic headlines around New Hampshire, from wages to gas prices to unemployment to construction. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. How cheerful or not are you feeling about the New Hampshire economy? What do you make about some of the numbers that you're hearing about, from rising wages to low unemployment to slow GDP growth here in the Granite State? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. www.thechinese.org. And Steve Norton, Russ Thibault, Jeff Feingold, back to our listeners. Here's an email from Thomas who says, the $800 billion saved from lower gas and heating oil prices has largely gone to make up for a lack of wage increases and to pay for higher health care costs and debt accumulated since 2008. Thomas says it's another sign things are not as good as they should be. Thomas, thank you for the email. 2 points from this, guys, that I want to follow up on. First to you, Russ. He says it's gone to make up for a lack of wage increases and debt. Now, we talked about the debt earlier, that people are using that to pay off debt. What about wage increases? I thought you had said that wages are finally picking up.
That's the key word in that question to me, Laura, is finally.
So just now.
Just now. Just
6 years of supposed economic recovery.
So it's just beginning. We're just beginning to see real wage growth. And part of it is because the structure of the economy has changed a little bit. In other words, if you're in the technology sector, we're adding jobs in that sector. That job pays higher than average wages. So they bring the average up. But if you're in another sector, wages may not have increased at all. Going to his point about health care, going back to that Fed survey, nearly a third of the household surveys said they had foregone medical care that they felt they needed during the past year because they couldn't afford it. You get high deductibles, and I know Steve's done a lot of work in the healthcare field, but high deductibles, high insurance premiums, and it's really draining, as we see in this survey, at least a third of the households in the country.
So even if your wages are picking up, Russ, if you're shelling out, you know, more money on healthcare, you're not feeling so good about that.
Yeah, if you need an aspirin, don't go to the hospital to get it because it'll be exorbitantly
expensive. I'd love to talk to both of you guys about healthcare. And Jeff, to you first, you know, this is a sector formerly seen as robust, you know, hospitals expanding, hiring nurses and so forth. But now that I read about, you know, expansion in some areas, but some struggles in other areas. What's going on?
Yeah, so we've seen in recent days the Elliott Hospital is shutting its ICU for infants and
pediatric intensive care unit shutting down. And Concord Hospital closed the Center for Integrative Medicine. You know, big disappointment to people who accessed care there.
And also the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth has laid off several people and is restructuring.
Lakes Region has laid off 58 people.
Yeah, 58 people up at Lakes Region has happened. They've undergoing a major restructuring. They had cuts of, you know, I think $20 million in expenses.
This is a sector a couple years ago was
Absolutely.
A growth sector.
Yes, and it was, and it's interesting because what's happened is with the Affordable Care Act now that the industry really has changed. It's changing, and as we've seen, costs have not really come down the way the word affordable and the Affordable Care Act promises it to be. Although healthcare premiums, we just did a story about how these new co-ops, these consumer-oriented and operated plans that are subsidized by the federal government to encourage their, you know, their creation, they've had some financial issues. The one based in Maine called Community Health Options and the one in Massachusetts called Minuteman Health, they've had some financial issues. And part of it was because basically they've been successful in attracting people who haven't had health care insurance in many years or haven't had it ever. And they've been utilizing this, and that's really, you know, if you have a chronic problem, but you've never had it treated, all of a sudden you're being treated, and they've had to pay out their expenses. You know, the insurance company has to pay for this stuff.
So new populations with lots of health issues that have not been treated before, and at first anyway, it's expensive.
It's expensive for the insurers.
Right.
Because, you know, they're collecting the premiums, and they have to kind of predict how much their premiums are. That's why Minuteman is saying that they might have to raise their rates up to 45% for their individual insurers, but their group insurance rates are just going up at 1.5%, which is very manageable considering the past, you know, 10, 20 years. But in terms of the hospitals, it's really just a matter of a need for – we've seen this in the industry nationally. There's been a big wave of consolidation in the industry.
That's been going on for some
time. And really considering our population – you know, it's possible that we maybe have too many hospitals or too many hospitals offering the same services. You know, Dartmouth has a pediatric intensive care unit, and, you know, it's maybe geographically it's difficult for people in Manchester, but in terms of the entire population of New Hampshire, maybe that is what we can afford is only one pediatric intensive care unit. And the same is true for other kinds of especially services. And you've seen that happen in the North Country. Actually, there's been, I think, the four hospitals up there have kind of merged together, have formed an alliance. So they offer different kinds of services and not the same. They don't want to overlap. which helps affect their costs.
Sure. So million-dollar question, Steve Norton. I mean, the impact of the Affordable Care Act, especially Medicaid expansion here in New Hampshire, on this broader health care struggle, is it related or not?
Well, yes. The big primary driver in the healthcare market in New Hampshire is actually Medicare, the federal
program.
Nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act, because most CEOs will admit now that over half of their base is Medicare reimbursement, and that reimburses at less than the existing expenses that they incur. So for the first time in the 25 years that we've been looking at healthcare changes in New Hampshire, we're seeing expense growth at 2% per year as opposed to 10% per year in the hospitals. So they are being squeezed. Now, that's not to say that the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid expansion, changes in the cost of doing businesses, the wages are becoming as expensive here in New Hampshire as they are in Massachusetts for healthcare workers. So all these things are putting pressure on. But the real primary mover and shaker is Medicare right now.
Do you want to jump in, Russ?
Which is independent of all the insurance companies
that's,
as well.
That's
so
correct.
So what's happening at the Medicare world is not affecting what's going on in businesses, employers having higher premiums or whatever.
Well, and Steve, you did some work a couple years ago, I think, about this sort of hospital sector as local economic engines. So when hospitals start to contract and cut units and so forth, people get worried.
Yeah, typically the largest employer in many communities outside of maybe even including southern New Hampshire, the largest single employer is
the hospital.
And imagine this. That back in 1990, for every $10 that were being made in the state, 55% were manufacturing. And now healthcare is as big an employer as manufacturing.
Let's go back to our listeners. Gentlemen, again, the exchange number for you to join us as we wrap up some of the top economic headlines around the state, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. To Franconia, where Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to comment. I've been in the North Country 60 years. My dad and mom were in the ski business way back before snowmaking. And I just wanted to – it was a tough business.
It can be done.
Five kids on, but we all got the opportunity to go to college, so that's all great. But I just wanted to comment about this upcoming Cannon and Mittersell partnership that we've been able to raise $4 million privately, but it's a partnership between the state of New Hampshire, Cannon Mountain, a state-run area, and Holderness School, Franconia Ski Club, and USSA, which is the United States Ski Team. Well, the terrain up there is great. They've – come in to say, we would love to be able to train there too. So we've got financing sources that are very diverse. We've come together, put this great venue together, and it will have an impact on lengthening the season up there for state employees, for local employees. It'll bring more coaches into the area, and it'll bring a lot of ski teams in for the training that this will provide for the area. And as you might or might not know, the World Cup ski race tour is coming back to the East for the first time in 20 years, so that will be another positive push for the ski industry in the Northeast. All those things are on the horizon and a positive thing for the North Country economy, which is always looking for creative infusions.
Well, that's great. And Mike, thank you for calling. And Jeff Feingold, it reminds me of something that I feel like I'm hearing more of lately, that economic development needs to be public-private partnership. You can't just count on the businesses to do it on their own. They've got a lot of struggles, and that communities, they need to partner with companies to make this good stuff happen. Thank you so much for calling, Mike.
That's a very good point, and that's something, and also actually if you look about the public sector too, that they're not always eager to put all the money on the line as well. So having these partnerships, which it has happened in New Hampshire before, and
sure,
it will continue to happen. I think a really good example is that Pettingill Road that Russ talked about, which is the road that goes to the it's in Londonderry and Derry, and it goes to the airport. It's been they worked for years to try to get this going, and it's come up and it was built, finally open, and we've already seen a major economic development along that stretch of highway or road, and that's the kind of stuff that we're talking about. This thing in Cannon is another example of it, and it's like, I don't want to be trite about it, but that's kind of like a New Hampshire type of solution that has happened around the state and it will probably continue.
Good for you, Mike. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, it's kind of my pet peeve that we don't have more of this because there have been a lot of good examples of success,
yes.
Public-private partnerships that have been successful in the state.
Pease is the number
one. A windfall,
yeah.
10,000 jobs, a public-private partnership. As you pointed out, Pettingill Road, public-private partnerships. A lot of the downtown rejuvenation that we've seen in downtown Manchester, for example, public-private partnership. But it seems the state is reluctant to repeat the successes that it's had. I don't get it.
And it's also a phrase that comes out of the mouths of people in Concord, but you know, actions speak louder than words.
Well, maybe it's more feasible locally, Russ. Maybe the state doesn't get involved because it's too messy.
There's limits to what local can do. New York Times a couple of years ago did a story on state economic development efforts. And I think New Hampshire ranked 47th or 46th. It was 45th, lowest in terms of participating in the economic development process directly. We really have a long history of passive economic development at the state level. We were fortunate. We could count on companies border jumping, compact computer, digital, to fuel the state's economic growth. And other communities were asleep at the switch. Now I think it's reversed. We're kind of asleep at the switch, and places like Texas, South Carolina, California are just booming, and we're just sitting there kind of dozing off.
But the other thing is that states
– Wow, that's harsh.
Well, and that's not to be critical of any of the people that work at DRED and their efforts. It's just I think it's more the state policy. It's not the people.
I think one of the things that we compare – if you compare to other states like Texas and Mississippi, all these states, they
– Mississippi?
Well, Mississippi, what they do is that they spend a lot of money. They give companies big money, hundreds of million dollars to build a plant there.
Okay, but New Hampshire doesn't.
New Hampshire
do
doesn't
that.
Do that, and that's one of the reasons for the low ranking.
Right.
New Hampshire doesn't do a pay for play. You know?
Not a lot of evidence that actually keeps businesses there, but I think there is fertile ground in Concord for conversations about what we could possibly do for economic development purposes.
You mean in Concord, not the city, but at the state
at
house.
At the state house,
yeah.
Correct. But I think there's really uncertainty out there about what you can do. What are the levers that a state has that would actually have a positive impact? Let's talk about business profits tax. Big conversation in the last legislative session about what we were going to do with our very high corporate taxation. We lowered it a little bit. In my opinion, and probably most economists would say, that little bit probably wouldn't have an economic impact. It might make people think about New Hampshire slightly differently. They're going to lower their business taxes. Well, are we now? We're facing potentially a surplus in this budget year coming up. Will we lower business taxes in a meaningful way to bring capital-intensive, high-profit businesses here to New Hampshire? I don't know. What impact will that be? That's the conversation I think that we've got to have. Everyone is interested in making sure that we convert this really great economy into a forward-looking economy, but no one's certain how.
And Jeff, I can see you want to jump in, but just real quick, Steve, because this is an important point. So there was this big drama last year over whether we should lower business taxes or not. The governor and Democrats said, no, 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 it'll blow a hole in the state budget. Lo and behold, we have $100 million surplus.
That's correct.
So that did not come to pass.
That's true. Revenues came in much stronger than were budgeted, and there is now a conversation going on in Concord about, well, what do you do with that? Does that go into the rainy day fund for the next rainy day?
Opioid addiction. Roads and bridges.
Roads and bridges.
The list is long.
Yes, the list will always be long for that. And economic development will be a part of that, and there are champions of that now in the legislature. What can we meaningfully do? Infrastructure, lowering corporate taxes,
schools,
to forward our economy going forward.
Go ahead,
the
Jeff.
Other thing to remember is this bill that was passed in 2015 to lower the tax rates, the BPT we'll use for example, is that it went down from 8.5 to 8.2 this year, and we have this surplus, and then it's scheduled to go down to another 7.9. And the whole thing was there was a trigger. They're saying, well, as long as the revenues weren't affected, well, so it's apparently going to be going up down to 7.9. And the argument among the business community is that low enough? Oh, is it still? It's still relatively high. It could be a barrier. So I am sure in the next session there'll be more of a discussion about let's lower it even more. It didn't have a negative effect this year. Although you could argue that, you know, what we've been talking about for the last hour, that, you know, the economy has rebounded enough where there has been more tax revenue generated, whether it's because of the lower tax rate or not. It's that, you know, it's not definitely you can't prove anything like that right now.
Here's an email from Robert in Epsom. He says, does anyone think growth is overrated and that the tighter people's budgets are, the more they feel the need to keep up with appearances? The first question we ask as a greeting is, how are you doing? We need the biggest 10-gallon hat, the biggest SUV, the biggest plate of food. If we weren't trapped by our high expenses, we could retire early and make room for the next generation coming up behind us. Russ, you know, this is a great comment, and it's a whole show we could do, Russ, but it is the idea that, you know, people say you need two jobs to get by these days. And then other people say, like this person, a long time ago, we just had less.
Yeah, I think that the sense is that we always want to move forward. And in America, I think for almost forever, certainly throughout my lifetime, moving forward meant having more stuff. Yeah. So I think that there is an element of that having two cars is important, having, you know, the best television, internet, a cell phone. You know, between the internet and cell phone, you can be spending $300 a month readily. And that used to be rent. So there is some of that. I think there is some of that where the expectations are high.
Well, thank you for the email. And guys, I do want to close out with you all just saying, okay, what are you going to be looking at over the next month or so? Jeff Feingold, what economic trends or events are you going to be keeping an eye on?
I'm keeping an eye on the construction sector in the state. That's something that's really essential. And this past winter has been very kind to the construction industry in New Hampshire because it was still active because of the mild weather.
They didn't have to do that.
So
we're going to
see, and we'll see what kind of building. There's been projects planned that are pretty impressive, and be keeping an eye on that.
Commercial construction,
yes.
As well as housing.
Yeah,
go ahead, Steve. What are you going to be looking at?
Economic response to this Thursday's GDP numbers.
Right, that Russ mentioned earlier.
If confidence continues to plummet, then we're not going to see an expansion.
It's a big week. The Fed meets this week, may or may not raise interest rates. Most feel they won't. And I agree, the GDP figure that's released Thursday. So this Wednesday and Thursday are two watershed days for the next quarter of the economy.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on all that, and we'll talk to you guys again. Thank you very much for being here. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. We have help this week from Michael Brinley. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.